Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Robert Logan, 30 years of combination experience, a district chief with Houston Fire Department and assistant chief with Spring Fire Department just outside Houston. Growing up without a father figure in his life, Robert lived across from a fire station. The men within that station became bigger brothers to Robert at the age of 8. The examples of how they carried themselves as firefighters and men meant a great deal to Robert, and the end result became who he is today. Mentorship and being a leader to others can go such a long way for individuals who need that guidance in their life, and Robert is a prime example of this. I hope the listeners can tune into the message and absorb the information Robert speaks. With that, I present Robert Logan.
Hi, Danny. Thanks for having me on Student of the Game podcast. I just want to thank you for the opportunity to talk about how I got in the fire service and all the topics I'm passionate about. My name's Robert Logan. This is my 30th year in the fire service. I started as a volunteer at 16. I've been with the Spring Fire Department here just north of Houston for 15 years. And I've been with the Houston Fire Department going on my 24th year. I'm a district chief with Houston, and I'm the assistant chief here at Spring Fire Department. In Houston, I oversee 4 fire stations as a district chief in Southwest Houston. And then here at Spring, I oversee HR and 4 deputy chiefs. We have a group of about 138 full-time firefighters, and we also have a volunteer contingent here as well. So how I got involved in the fire service is I lived in an apartment complex across the street from the fire station. 8 years old, I started going across the street, hanging out at the fire station. I had a dad that really wasn't involved in my life. My mom worked a lot, and I was raised by a whole bunch of big brothers. And I think that the attitude I have towards service and being a leader in the fire service was really instilled in me from a very young age, just because I had those opportunities to hang out with those big brothers from being a very small age. I got to grow up real fast, and I got to be shown, you know, how to take pride in equipment, how to take pride in the job you're doing, and how to serve the community the best you can.
Okay. So ultimately, from the age of 8, or 9, no.
8.
8, you knew automatically that's what fire service was, what you wanted to do.
100%. There was no plan B. That's what I wanted to do. I usually say that every kid wants to be a firefighter. I just never grew out of it. And that's always what I wanted to do. I thought it was just one of the neatest things. And I'm super blessed that they were very welcoming to me. I mean, I'm sure that was a challenge for them, having an 8-year-old kid running around the fire station. And they were very welcoming. And like I said, I think the path that I've kind of gone down and the career I've had is all owed to them for as welcoming as they were to me.
Okay. So at what age did you start your formal volunteer process?
So when I started in 95, you had to be 16 and your mom had to sign your parents had to sign a form to kind of release liability. So a day before my 16th birthday, I handed her the form and said, "You already know this is coming." And she signed the form. You know, I'm sure, you know, begrudgingly, as a parent of 2 children, I can only imagine the stress I put her through. And I let her sign the form, took it to the fire station, and the Recruit Academy started on April 29th. And I went through a volunteer Recruit Academy. It was a lot of the big brothers I had that were the instructors. They were all career firefighters somewhere else. And we're also volunteers at that local department. And that's the way they gave back to their community, as well as being career firefighters. And I joined the Recruit Academy. I tried to pretend like I didn't already know a lot of things, but being there for 8 years listening and learning, I tried the best I could. So I tried to be a little humble and not, you know, have the attitude of, I got this, I can just make my way through the academy real fast. So that was a sticking point for me, where I just didn't want to act like I was the class leader, run around. I just wanted to be able to take it all in and you know, be humble.
Okay. And that is a very good attitude to have, for sure.
Well, like I said, I'm super blessed at how they raised me. And I think that if I would have got outside of that humility and started acting a little too big for myself, they would have wrangled me right back in.
Okay. Understood. All right. And so at what point in your in your life did you figure, hey, I want to do this full-time career-wise?
So I think that was always kind of the goal. At 18, I went to EMT school. At 20, I went to paramedic school because there was a group of us that said, hey, we should probably go become paramedics because let's make ourselves more marketable to the smaller fire departments. So Texas A&M has the Teeks Fire Academy where people come from all over the world. That was the top fire academy in the country at the time. And that was the only place I was going to go. That's the only place I wanted to go. I got on the waiting list. I spent the money, moved to College Station, went through the fire academy there. I tried to get involved in that level of, can I max out every possible thing? Can I be a paramedic? Can I be the best fire? I wanted to be as marketable as I could. Houston Fire Department wasn't even on my radar. And the reason I say that at that time in the early 2000s, you had to have 60 college hours, and there was no such thing as a modified fast track academy. I didn't have 60 college hours. I went straight from high school to EMT school to paramedic school. And then in the early 2000, I think in January of 2000, they created a program for fast track. If you were a certified firefighter and EMT, you only had to have 15 college hours, and you would do a 10-week academy versus going through a full academy. So I thought, why not go work for the busiest department in the area? There was a lot of things that the city was doing in the early 2000s about annexing. They were kind of taking other areas, they were growing. And I really had a fear of going to an organization around Houston. And if they ended up getting annexed many years down the road, could I potentially lose my job? Would that, there was a lot of instability I wasn't sure about. And I knew that if I went to the big city that didn't have those same challenges that other departments did, that I think I would feel more secure. And to be honest, there wasn't a lot of other fire departments that surrounded Houston that were career organizations. There were still a lot of volunteer departments. There were still only part-time staff that operated at them while the volunteers weren't around. So we didn't have a lot of opportunities. Like as a kid, I remember seeing a group of firefighters would load up in a pickup truck every weekend and they would drive all over Texas testing at every fire department in Texas just because they wanted a career job and there just weren't that many opportunities. And they didn't care where it was in Texas. They were going to pack up and move if they got a fire department job. All they knew they wanted to be was a career firefighter. They didn't care where, they were just going to go. And they would pack up, and every weekend there would be 300 people testing for three spots. And a lot, sometimes they got the job, sometimes they didn't. I watched people come and go. Some people moved to other parts of Texas. And then I was super fortunate in the early 2000s, there was a huge influx of hiring for Houston. So I came in as a fast track in November of 2001. And I guess the rest is history.
Okay. With that being said, what was your first, well, before I get to that question, with the fast track, I'm assuming, of course, you have to kind of go through the way Houston does things. Was that an adjustment for you, or did you kind of like go, hey, I'm going to be a part of another academy. Why not absorb more skills?
That was 100% my attitude. I just looked at it as it's just another fire academy. I had finished the Teeks Fire Academy in April and then got hired in Houston in November. So there'd only been like a 7-month gap. So luckily, I was probably still in shape. It didn't make it as challenging that if it would have been a couple of years, I think it would have been harder for me. But I just said, this is where I want to work. I put my head down and I came out number two in the academy. And I just wanted to work as hard as I could and kind of have the same attitude that was instilled in me early on was don't act like you know everything, be humble. Don't say, oh, I've already been to fire school. Everybody in my academy class had been to fire school, whether they had gone to a local community college or where they had gone to Teeks. We had all come. Some of the guys in my academy had worked in a fire department for 5, 6, 7 years and had quit to start in Houston because that's where they wanted to work. And that was the first time an opportunity like that had happened in many, many years, if at all ever, because a majority of us didn't have the 60 college hours. So when they changed the requirements to the 15 hours, we all kind of were like, okay, well, now I have that because I went to EMT school through a community college and I got some community college hours, which gave me the opportunity with a fire certification to apply there. So I just kept my head down, worked hard, pretended like I never saw a fire truck before, and just did what I could and kept my nose to the ground.
Okay. And upon completion and graduating, what was your first assignment?
I was at Station 9, which is on the outskirts of the downtown proper. We get to pick our stations, and the two things that were important to me was I wanted to be downtown where it was going to be busy, and I wanted a two-story fire station so I could slide the fire pole. And I had, as a volunteer, we had one-story stations. I had never been exposed to that before, and I did my research, and Station 9 was one of the choices. And I said, it's a two-story station right on the edge of downtown, the north side of the downtown proper is its territory. And I said, how cool would it be to really get to be a firefighter and slide down the fire pole?
Okay. Yeah, can't argue the reasons there.
I wish I had a better answer, but I mean, it's true.
Okay. And so upon walking through those doors of Station 9, did you seek out those firefighters you had back when you were 8, or was that pretty much like a non thing with Houston, where if you're a part of Houston Fire Department, you are going to be all into the job?
Well, I think you're going to have to be all into the job. There were firefighters there that kind of introduced themselves that morning to me and were like, hey, welcome. My first interaction was a guy that came up to me as I was checking out my air pack, and he goes, oh, so you're the rookie? And I said, yeah. He goes, great. You're the reason I'll be on the ambulance every day. Thanks. And he walked off, and I said, okay. I didn't know any different. I was the rookie. And you don't understand how the attitude changes or the dynamic of the attitude of the firefighters when they're having to fill in at a different station or they're having to ride the ambulance more because you're permanently on the fire truck every day. You don't realize that when you're the rookie. But I had the same attitude again, be a hard worker. I knew the rules were bring cake and ice cream. Yes, sir, no, sir. Work hard, clean the fire truck, do everything you're supposed to do, show up early. Attitude and effort is what's going to make them be supportive of you, and that's just what I did. I just worked hard, and I tried to, be a good sponge and learn everything I could from my captain. And it was the thing that separated Houston from where I had come from as a volunteer is everything felt so much faster. When we would make fires, I felt like everything occurred so quickly on the fire ground because when I was at the volunteer department, sometimes we would be alone for a while. Because you're waiting for a further station to come away. We're in the city, it's so dense. The fire stations are so close to each other. You would show up and like everyone's there, and you felt like you were just getting shoved in the front door and pushed out the back door and just put fire out as fast as you can. And I was like, this is just so fast. And I just felt like I never had the opportunity to slow down and look around and breathe because everything was going so fast. I'm sure it had to do with being the rookie, being nervous, trying to get your bearings of the system you're in, but that was the one thing that always stuck out for me was how fast everything happened.
Okay. All right. And is there a time period where once you're not a rookie or you come off probation, then do you get floated to the ambulance, or do you stay on the engine for as long as you want?
So you have phase testing, and once you've completed phase testing at the then you become a credentialed EMT is what they call it, right? So you complete your phase testing, you become credentialed, which then allows you to ride on the ambulance. And then you just get in the rotation. So the firefighters all rotate. So once I got off probation and credential or was credentialed, I transferred to the district house, which had the chief, the engine, the ladder, the ambulance, and the paramedic squad. So I went there because I really wanted to work at a fire station that had the ladder truck because I wanted to learn that part of the job. You do it in a real short period of time in your second phase as the rookie, but I wanted to be able to be on the fire truck or on the ladder truck every day so I could really learn that part of the job. And that was just something for me because I didn't want to be in a senior captain on a ladder truck that I really didn't understand how the whole operation worked at the firefighter level. So that was important to me, was to learn every bit of the job I could, which was so as I promoted through the ranks, I understood every phase of the job.
Okay. All right. And so at what point in your career, it's a two-part question. What point in your career did you decide to start moving up the ranks, and why?
So my first interaction with my chief was something that I think most rookies probably don't experience because there's a lot of standoffish at times. The chiefs don't really get involved in the rookies. They kind of let the captains handle it. And mine was just an awesome human being. His name was Phil Hudgens, probably one of the greatest mentors I've ever had. He was larger than life. He was a huge man. And I remember him calling me upstairs, probably my second or third day there, sitting at the kitchen table eating chips and salsa and just asking questions about me. And you could just feel the care in his heart. And I just kind of watched how he interacted. And he always had a full district full of great officers and firefighters who desired to work for him, wanted to serve him well, wanted to do all the things to impress him and not disappoint him because of just who he was as a person. And at that moment, I said, that's who I want to be. And that was kind of the catalyst for me to one, transfer to the station where he was the chief at, so I could be around him more and learn more from him and work around great men and women and officers that were at that fire station. Because there's a, in Houston, you know, each district has a district house, and you always kind of felt when you worked at the district house, those were the people who wanted to be at the chief's house kind of wanted to excel at a different level than the other stations because you're held to a different standard when you work at the chief's house. And that's just the culture, and that's the way it's always been. So I saw that and I said, that's where I want to be. And conveniently they had the ladder truck there and it had every type of apparatus that responded every day, ambulance, paramedic squad, engine, ladder, all those things. So what I wanted to do was get there and to be able to absorb it all in, learn everything I could from all the jobs, but more importantly, learn everything I could from the officers, including Chief Hudgens, who worked there to make me a better person.
Okay.
And that was the real motivate. That's what drove me to go to continue to promote.
Okay. And I'm trying to remember, you're not allowed to skip rank in Houston, are you?
You're not.
Okay. So you went through, you started going through each
Become a
step.
driver. I drove an ambulance. You start at the bottom of seniority, which is an ambulance. You do a couple of years driving the ambulance and you make your way. So I stayed at when I promoted, I went to another station to drive an ambulance because you go where the openings are. I was there for 3 months, came right back to Station 19, stayed there as an ambulance chauffeur at Station 19. I moved over to drive the engine on Engine 19, drove the ladder truck on Ladder 19, and then I promoted out of there as a captain. And there was no openings there, so I got moved around the city, and then I ended up being a captain on Engine 8 downtown.
Okay. Where you first started?
Well, Nines is where I started,
Nines.
right next to
Nines.
it. Yeah, so
Okay.
station, there's only one station in true downtown Houston. It's got two engines, a chief, ambulance, medic. It's an 8-bay huge station. And that's where it was close enough to where I'd always worked. I'd kind of been comfortable. And my attitude was I wanted to get out of my comfort zone. When I worked at Station 19, we had one story, very small shotgun shack houses. I said, we bordered downtown, so we did make some high-rise boxes down there, but it wasn't at the level we were involved in as if you worked in downtown in those buildings every day. So when I became a captain, I said, I want to go to Station 8. I want to put myself out of my comfort zone. And I always had the attitude, if I could work at Station 8, I can work anywhere. If I can deal with the high rises, I can work anywhere. And I said, I'm going to go there and just kind of absorb it all in, be all encompassing of every bit of that job in those buildings and elevators and alarm panels. I wanted the whole gamut of what they had down there to just kind of take it all in because we don't have basements in Houston, but there's a lot of buildings downtown that have basements. So I was like, okay, that's a different tactic I need to be prepared for. So I tried to get myself in a totally different mindset working there where I knew that if I was comfortable working there, I could probably go anywhere else in the city and still be comfortable.
Okay. And would you say one advantage that you have above others is the fact that Houston actually does see fire?
Oh, we see plenty of fire. And I think, but you can go to stations that don't. You know, there are parts of town that just aren't as busy when it comes to fires as others. Like where I'm a chief in Southwest Houston, it's nonstop. You know, the three busiest chiefs in the fire department are the three chiefs that are in Southwest Houston. And we alternate between one, two, and three and run volume, and we usually rotate between one, two, and three and who has the most fires for the year. And it's just that part of town is extremely dense. There's a large population, lots of apartments, lots of commercial buildings. It's a large part of the city. And that part of town for my whole career has just been that way. Lots of fires.
Okay.
And the same thing happened when I made chief. I said, I'm going to go to that side of town if there's an opening, because again, it's going to put, I wanted to be in the game as much as I could.
Now, did you ever think in your entire career you would be a district chief for one of the largest departments in the country?
I think once I got hired in Houston and I really got exposed to my first chief of the way he acted and behaved, I said, if I can, and he, we had a lot of long conversations about studying, how to study, why you should study. He was very service oriented. He had a servant's heart. And I mean that when it comes to serving the community as much as serving us as the people who worked for him. And I think once I was able to kind of wrap my head around what he was teaching me, I said, that's definitely what I want to do. So I think probably at that moment, I realized that I could easily get there if I put in the time and effort. I have a great support system at home. My wife, her dad was a fireman, and my kids were great. So she kind of understands the whole dynamic of being a firefighter. And she was super supportive when it came time to study, to, kind of step away from raising the kids and going to the volleyball games and missing things because I was really putting my nose in the book, but I had a greater purpose, and she completely understood the reason why, and she was so supportive. So I think once all that happened, it made it real easy for me to see that that was achievable. But what, as an 8-year-old kid, absolutely not.
Understood. Is there a difference between a battalion chief and a district chief, or is it really the same?
Same thing. They used to be called battalion chiefs many, many years ago, and they changed the name from battalion chief to district chief, I think 1940s, 50s. It's the same concept. They just changed the title from battalion to district chief.
And do you have an aide, or is it just you in the car?
I do have a name. Yeah.
You do have an aide.
Yeah, they call them incident command technicians. They're called ICTs. And we as chiefs get to pick them. So it's not about seniority. We actually get to choose. They have to be from the engineer operator rank. They have to be a driver rank, and then we can pick whoever we want to drive us. But it's a really big responsibility. It's not just a person who drives me around. I always say that you have to be the yin and my yang, because there's things that, the radio gets chaotic. I can look at him and say, hey, what did he say? He might have caught something. He's got to run the electronic accountability system. We have to have a great working relationship, because he's the only person I can talk to in the car. When it's going bad, or I look at him and say, hey, what do you think? I have to be able to rely on his experience to say, hey, Chief, I think we might need to look at maybe going defensive, or maybe changing our tactics to, or get a hand line ahead of the fire, and usually it's things I'm thinking, and I'm just looking to him for reassurance. It definitely has made a huge impact on me to be able to have that conversation with that person I can really rely on.
This is more of a personal question. When you arrive on location of a fire, do you two stay in your vehicle, or do you kind of park yourself where you get out? Like, are you more of a stationary command or mobile command?
So I'm more of a stationary command, because especially with us having the electronic accountability system in the car, it monitors people's air. It monitors if they hit their Mayday button. So there's a lot of stuff that happens in there that if we just abandon that to go stand in the front yard, there's a lot of things we would miss. Now, when we pull up on scene, he knows to park in a position where I can see. And his first assignment, I always laugh and say he should wear track shoes, because his first assignment is to run and give me a real good look at the building and then come back. Because I don't need the accountability system in the first 45 seconds, because crews are still arriving, deploying hand lines. They're not even in the IDLH yet. So I tell him, run and give me a real good 360 and let me know what it looks like. Because sometimes he comes back and say, hey, it's just going to be one unit. It's not in the attic yet. And I can kind of see where I'm at. Or if the fire's in the back of the house, he can say, hey, it looks really bad in the back. We might want to consider putting hand lines in the back. And that's why I said I really have to use him as a good eyes and ears for me, because I don't like getting out of the car, because the times I have, it's way too easy to miss radio traffic. And the front yard is so chaotic with pumps running and ladders going by and saws running. And I just like to be closed in to that space where I can hear, because I always monitor the radio, expecting the next radio transmission to be a Mayday.
Obviously, that ICT, that is a very important role and function, because you mentioned how that individual does your 360. So I would imagine the person that you choose to do that role has to be into the job, because the first thing I thought about when you mentioned it was, let's just say that ICT misses something they should have seen. They come back and tell you this is what it looks like, and then something bad happens. Does that fall on you or the district chief, or how does that work?
Oh, I'm always going to take the responsibility. Like, that's 100%. That fire ground is 100% my problem, my fault. If it goes well, great for me. If it goes bad, it's still my problem. Now, each company officer is still going to conduct their own 360.
Okay.
He's just giving me my initial 360, what it looks like when we pull up, especially if the conditions are starting to change. I kind of have a benchmark of where we started, and I kind of have an idea of what it looked like when we got there. And he can look at me and say, this has gotten significantly worse since we've been here. And usually he's not going to see anything I'm not seeing, or he's not going to think anything I'm not thinking. We've been together for almost 4 years now. And I think that relationship is obviously built over time of all the tons of fires we've made together. But every arriving company officer is going to do their own 360. I still expect the first in engine company, as they're deploying the hand line, for the captain to do a 360, just because they're the ones who are going to battle.
Right.
They're the ones who need to know what they're going in to see. Just relying on me giving a radio report of what my ICT saw as a 360 is not going to set that captain up for success.
Okay.
They need to be able to see what they're going into. They're the ones who are going into battle. I'm sitting in an air-conditioned car. Mm-hmm. And they need to be able to see where the traps are. You know, where's it? Maybe it'd be better if they went in a side door versus the front door, or maybe they need to deploy the hand line to a different place. And the only way they're going to figure that out is doing their 360.
Okay.
Right. But I still have that as an expectation as an incident commander, that they're all still going to conduct their 360s.
Okay. And I'm assuming the only type of calls you respond to are structural boxes, pin-ins or entrapments, like something greater than a regular fire alarm activation.
Right. So we make gas leaks, whether they're like a cut gas line below ground, someone's putting a fence in, breaks a gas line, gas leaks inside buildings. Anything that would create an IDLH, we go mm-hmm. to structure fires, we go to chemical leaks, we go to tanker trucks on fire, we go to extrications. So yeah, anything that could quickly escalate, that they dispatch a chief on.
Okay. And then would there ever be a situation where a higher chief comes and takes command or assumes command from you, or once you own that scene, that's yours?
So the highest ranking chief we have on shift is a deputy chief. That's the next step above me. And there's two on each shift. There's north side, south side. So our policy states that when you get to a third alarm or greater, they're supposed to become incident command, and then you become operations. And the three alarm fires and greater are very few and far between. That we do have a lot of, you know, second alarms when you get apartments that, you know, kind of get in a common attic and kind of get out of hand, or they're out of hand before you even get there.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times the third alarm, but usually they don't try to come in and take over. They're there as a great support. And I'm super blessed to have one that's very supportive of me. We kind of have a great, so anytime there's a second alarm or greater, they get dispatched, but they're always listening to the radio. So they'll show up sometimes on even just the one alarm fires we have. But the system we have is he gets in the back seat of the truck, he becomes my resource officer. We put all the companies that are staging on a separate channel. So I'll just sit, when he sits behind me, I'll turn around and say, I need two engine companies to Charlie. He can call staging. He says, I need two engine companies to Charlie. And he'll say, you're getting engine 51 and engine 28.
Okay.
So I'll tell Charlie, we're sending these two. So he becomes my communication with staging and becomes the resource officer. And all I have to do is turn around and look to him and say, this is what I need, as division officers start to call for help. Then he just kind of helps coordinate them out of staging. We put staging on a separate channel so it doesn't clutter up the radio.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. With that being said, I'm going to ask you a personal question. In your opinion, what does the term aggressive firefighter, or I'm sorry, what does the term aggressive mean to you?
So I think it's when I hear that term, people initially go to, you're just going to go in every fire, no matter what. You want to be aggressive and you want to be, I don't want to say careless, but sometimes they make people are a little too much. One of the greatest terms, when I went to station 19, my captain, he said to me, he goes, we're going to be aggressive and we're going to be smart. We're going to be smartly aggressive. He goes, if it's a time that we need to go in and be aggressive, then that's what we're going to do. If we're not going to be aggressive, or if we don't need to be aggressive, then we're not going to be stupid.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to go put ourselves in bad situations just for the sheer fact of putting ourselves in bad situations. And I think people do that at times, which is just a terrible idea. But there are those marginal calls that maybe there is somebody inside. You get reports of people trapped. Those are the times when, you're really going to have to go in and probably lean more towards being a little too aggressive, but you're doing it because there's a risk reward. So I look at the term aggressive, but I also like to interchange the term aggressive with passionate. Like, I think people are passionate in what they do because, like, you can be passionate in the administrative duties of your job as much as you can on the fire ground. And I want to be, and I'm not trying to, give you a plug. I want to be a student of the game,
Right.
but I really do because I think that's an aggressive mindset as well. It doesn't necessarily mean I'm going in a fire to be dangerous or be overly aggressive, but I want to be aggressive to the fact that I want to be able to take all the information I can get and have that mindset to say, am I well prepared for whatever comes for me today when the lights click on? And I think it's a mentality that's all encompassing, not necessarily being aggressive, just going into a fire.
But Houston has a long-standing tradition of you're going to search, fires are going to get put out. Of course, like you have to look at the structure, like you said, educationally sound, but there's no doubt about it. Like when Houston Fire Department shows up, they own that scene and they deem whatever to be clear until they say it's clear.
There's some truth to that. And I mean, I think there was a quote from Alan Brunicini. He always said, "Hey, if I'm trapped in a fire, I want a Houston firefighter coming to get me." And and I think that that's something that's you could be prideful about. But then I also think sometimes that creates an environment for people to make bad decisions. Like, I have to be aggressive. Well, you don't have to be aggressive. You have to be smart. And there are times that we call buildings defensive. And it's okay because sometimes, you're going to show up on scene and you're just not going to win. And the environment, maybe it was a delay in the call or the fire had progressed much faster than you had expected before you got there. It's an abandoned building sitting in the middle of a parking lot. It's okay to say, we're going to write this one off and be defensive and not be stupidly aggressive. And I think that comes from a culture. Yes, we're going to be aggressive when we need to be aggressive. And I know that we get that term of we're an aggressive fire department. And I think that's a good thing at times, but sometimes people use that to their advantage to say, I want to be aggressive when they probably border on times they shouldn't have been. And I don't even think that's a Houston thing. I think that's a fire service thing where, there's times that I think people put themselves in positions they probably shouldn't have been in to start with. And I have been just as guilty as the next guy. I've gone to fires and come out and saw a video and said it didn't look like that when we went in. And
Okay.
I'm just as guilty as the next guy. And the older I've gotten, the more fires I've got under me, the more mature I guess I've become. I always say the best thing an officer can have is a thing I like to call tactical maturity. And tactical maturity means you're mature enough to be able to be the one on the fire ground to say, nope, it's not today. This isn't the scene we're going to be aggressive on. And I
Understood.
think the fire service needs more people with tactical maturity.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Okay. With that being said, with you being the district chief, if I wanted to come in and work under your three or four stations that you cover, what are your non-negotiables if I wanted to come to you?
So my non-negotiables, that's a great question. I think the first thing is I don't want people that don't have a service mentality. And when I say service mentality, I don't mean just serving the public, I mean serving each other. People that take it out on a citizen, we see complaints because someone's having a bad day and they take it out on someone who called 911 because they're having their worst day. And yes, it might be the person who fell that you've made four times and you pick them up and it's in the middle of the night. And I don't tolerate people that take it out on them. Like, we're here to do a job, to provide a service, and that's what you're called to do. So you should show up, have a smile on your face. They're looking to us as the helpers, and we're there to help them. And I know that people let that get to them sometimes because they get tired, they get worn out, burn out, whatever terms you want to use. But for me, a non-negotiable is service. You have to have a service mentality. You have to be service mindset. of taking care of each other. I don't like when there's infighting in the fire station. Like, we are here for each other. You'll get mad at a guy because he did something at the dinner table, but you'll go die for him tonight.
Right.
And you need to have that mentality that we're here for each other all the time. And don't get me wrong, you can always tell when it's been a long time for a fire because you start to see the nitpicking happening, you start to see the little bickering happening, and then usually a fire comes and then everything's gone, everybody's happy again, right? And everybody feels and I think it's because you serve the community, you did your job, and that's what you're there for. And it kind of breaks up the monotony, but they have to serve each other as much as they have to serve the community. Another non-negotiable for me is looking professional. And the reason I say that is I know that people will tell me all day long, and I'll get hammered by saying this, that they don't care what you look like when they show up. And there might be some truth to that, but for me, when you're in the public, you want to look professional. If you're laying on a hospital bed and a doctor walks in and you're about to go to surgery, do you want the one who's clean shaven with his hair looking nice in a long white coat that starts ready to go, or do you want the disheveled looking doctor who probably barely made it through medical school? And I say, which one do you want to go under the knife? Do you want the person who looks professional or the person who doesn't? So to me, it's a pride thing about looking the part, but I'll say the last negotiable I have is knowing your job. So you have to know your job. You need to look like you're professional and know your job, and you have to have a service mentality. And knowing your job is knowing territory, knowing everything on the fire truck, training, all those things that come in. It's being a firefighter, being a student of the game. Like, I'll say it again. I mean, that's really what it's about. It's doing the job, knowing what you're supposed to do on any incident scene, looking professional when you show up, and having the mindset of a service mentality. If you can have those things, I think you're going to be a phenomenal employee and firefighter.
Love that. Okay. I swear I want to go to the next question. What has been a busy day for you like as a district chief? So like if you can just and you can shorten it up, but take us through your day. Like how did your day start?
So in the mornings, it starts with manpower, right? So all the stations call in where their manpower is for the morning. I usually get there about 40 minutes early just because it's, that's common practice in the fire service, right? Everybody, shows up. In Houston, shift changes at 6:30. So the guys that roll up the last second, we call them 6:29ers, right? So, but as a chief, right, I need to be there early because I check out my air pack, I put my gear on the car, I check out the car, even though I have an ICT who does all the same. I don't want someone checking. I have to wear that air pack today. That is my life-saving tool. I'm going to check it out. I'm going to make sure my gear is set up for me to be successful. So I go through all that. Then I go inside. The stations call in their manpower. The city's broke up into four quadrants. I'm the lead chief for the Southwest quadrant. So I manage all the manpower in that quadrant. And then it gets pushed up to the deputy chief. And then they call in overtime and they do all those things. I'll give you an example of I've been a district chief in Southwest Houston for 4 years. I've put 5-inch on the ground 90 times. And the reason I know that to be exact is because one of the other people I look as a mentor is a guy named Dale Jenkins.
Oh,
Okay. Right.
yes.
So one of the things that he had taught me a long time ago when we talked is he had written down every fire he had ever made when he had pulled an inch and three quarter attack on. And I thought, what a just a cool thing to be able to go back and look at. So when I made district chief, I said, you know what? I'm gonna do that. I'd never done it in any rank in my career. So I will sit here and tell you that I know that to be factual, that I have written down every time that I have been on the fire scene, whether division officer or the incident commander, in 4 years, I put 5-inch on the ground 90 times. And I'll tell you, there's been 4 days that I've made four working fires in the same shift. And those are busy days. Those are great days. From the firefighter standpoint, because that's a great way that our people are out doing good work for the community and they're serving each other and they're doing the things they need to be doing. So a busy day for me could be bogged down with manpower in the morning, or it could be a whole lot of fires in a day. And that's the one thing I really love about that job is just like any firefighter, you never know what's the next turn coming around the corner.
Right. Okay. With you being a leader, it's going to be another kind of two-part question. What
kind of leader did you want to be, and what does leadership look like to you? And I ask you this because Houston is not like, I can't compare Houston to where I work because it's two different things. You guys have so many personnel, so many stations.
Right.
But the thing is, you have so many influential leaders. You mentioned Dale Jenkins, Captain Dale Jenkins, and I've had Dale on here. You have individuals like Mo Davis, Chief Clyde Gordon, John Anning that I spoke to earlier. And he even mentioned other guys that are still senior captains, senior firefighters that are still on the job today. So with that being said, you had the playbook of leadership right there in front of you.
And I think for me, it's leadership isn't because you have a gold badge. There are tons of informal leaders in fire stations and in organizations that really are the ones who help kind of drive the culture. And all too often in the fire service, we kind of have the mindset of because your badge turned gold today, we didn't care what your opinion was yesterday. But today you're a captain and now you're the smartest person in the room because now you hold rank. And for me, I always looked at the station as like some of the greatest leadership traits I learned was from the people who drove the fire truck, who were 25, 30-year employees who had been a driver their whole career, didn't care to promote to captain, but you watch them on the fire ground or you watch them at the fire station and they were really the leaders. And what was really instilled in me in the beginning was the chauffeurs, engineer operators, whatever rank you want to call them, ran the fire station. Because if it got to the captain, it was going to be bad for all of us. So we had a lot of what we used to call silver badge meetings in the dorm when it was the chauffeurs running the meeting, ripping into the firefighters by saying, you guys aren't picking up the level you need to be at of taking care of the fire station, doing the things you're supposed to be doing. And when I got to that rank, I understood the role of leadership, even though I wasn't an officer. And I would say, hey, guys, let's go out and train. Hey, let's go out to the corn. Because if we were doing the things and the captains were like, good, these things are happening. Sure, they were there as supervisors, but I knew being in that rank, you were an informal leader. And for me, leadership is all about service. And I think a lot of people become promoted into positions with a self-serving mentality versus a serving mentality. Now, the benefit for me is, like I said, I'm the assistant chief here at Spring. We have nine fire stations, 138 people. So I can kind of look at it as 4,000 people, 180 people. So I can kind of look, and I have four deputy chiefs and HR that report to me as the assistant chief when I'm all admin, right? It's not. I can still get in the car and go to the fire ground, but I'm not getting dispatched. So I kind of have the, I'm able to manage both. So I try to take what is my lessons I've learned from Houston and leadership and bring it to this organization. And what are the things I learned administratively in this organization that I can take back to Houston? Because I try to explain to my guys in my district, you know, the easy whipping post is, you know, the command staff, the administration, everybody wants to be like, it's them, it's them, it's them. And I've always told my guys, I said, look, I do that role in another organization. If you think we have time to just sit there all day long going, who are we going to get today? You're crazy. I said, they don't sit downtown looking for ways to make your day worse. They're there. They're doing a hard job too. And their days are full of meetings and things they have to do and responsibilities as well. And they're just an easy scapegoat to blame. And I don't think that that's reality, but I think at the fire station, it's super easy when things happen a certain way to just point and go, what's them? And for me, what was taught by, like I said, my chief, who was a great mentor to me, was if you want to affect change in the organization and you want to serve people, you need to continue to promote and you need to get to that level to where you can have the ability to serve them, but you better keep a servant's heart. Don't turn it to where it becomes about you. It needs to always be about them. Every decision you make should always be about, is the decision that's going to happen today going to make their job better or worse? And the thought process should always be, what am I doing today to make, I come to work every morning going, what can I do today to make their job better, either in the field or in the administration building? Doesn't matter. And I think firefighters, it's the low-hanging fruit that they can just go, it's them. Well, everyone has a part in it, and you can't always just blame somebody because I don't think they're sitting down there looking at ways to get you. And too many times, firefighters in the whole fire service fall into that trap to go, that's just the easy person to blame.
Absolutely. And that's something I've learned through, you mentioned earlier, that maturity, getting older, a little bit wiser, and then talking to people where it's like, to have that mentality of we can blame one individual for creating this chaos that we have in our lives. And granted, like I said, I think it's a two-way street. Like, yes, there are certain things administration should do and needs to do and hold themselves accountable for, but to just sit there and blame one person who's not even in my fire station,
Right.
what's going on? Like, it's asinine. It really is.
Yeah, we had a a bad run a couple of years back in Houston. We had a contentious mayor. We had some bad, and I always told the guys at the kitchen table, I said, the woman across the street in that house, she expects you to show up on her door and serve her how you always have. It's not her fault that we haven't had a raise in so many years, haven't had a contract. You can't take it out on them. The people at this kitchen table are what matters to each other. We need to take care of each other, and we need to take care of the citizens. Don't get caught up in what's going on and things that we can't change. And I always loved firefighters when they come in and say, I don't want to get involved in politics. I said, your check comes from a government entity. You're involved in politics. But they say, I don't want to get involved in politics. But then they'll complain about the political wins when it doesn't go a way that they're happy about. And that's not fair either. It's like, just stay out of this. Focus on your job, do the things that you can control today, and all that will take care of itself.
Yes, no, for sure. Okay. With that, I'm going to kind of go switch gears a little bit. Can you tell us about Spring Fire Department? How many size, or I'm sorry, the size, amount of personnel, just a rundown of Spring.
Yeah, so 1953, the organization started as volunteers. All the way up into 1997, it was all volunteer. And in 1997, they hired what they called duty crew, which was career firefighters that worked part-time during the day while the volunteers were at their full-time job, right? Very common thing throughout the country. We hired our first full-time firefighter April 1st of 2013. So we're only 12 years old full-time, and we have 138 full-time staff on shift right now. We have a fire chief. I'm the only assistant chief. We have four deputy chiefs. And then we have HR, we have finance, we have community risk reduction, we have all the parts of a fire department. We still have some volunteers, and we have a couple of part-timers that are still left. So they plug in where people are off. We send our volunteers through almost a commissioned recruit academy. The plan is eventually to get them to a commissioned recruiter academy. And our attitude's always been when the parking brake hits and the four people come off that fire truck, you don't know who's part-time, full-time, or volunteer.
Fact.
And it's a great way to recruit because people come as volunteers and they go, this is awesome. How do I become a career firefighter? Well, here's the path. And you could still work here. There's no preferential treatment. They have to go through the process just like everybody else off the street. But we hire them. And the great thing for them is they kind of get to test it out first to see how the culture of the organization is and the things we do here. That help them become, and we have a lot of career firefighters that work for us that did start as volunteers.
Okay. Do you have battalion chiefs, captains, drivers, all that?
So we have nine stations. We have the apparatus has a, we call it apparatus operator instead of like, that's a term that we use. We have captains, and then we have district chiefs, and we actually just about 2 months ago split our district into halves and promoted three more to have two district chiefs on shift. They currently don't have aides. We're eventually going to get there. Our training chief has an unbelievable program that he wants to have in the future, and he deserves all the flowers for this process, I'll tell you, is he wants to create it as a captain's rank, not as a driver's rank. And his thought process is, which I think is just so amazing, is your first promotion as a captain as you drive the chief. You get exposed to leadership at a different level. You get exposed to expectations. You get to know what goes on in the car. You get to handle discipline with the chief. You get to come to administration and see those things that happen. And now when you go to the fire station, you've already built the relationship with your chief. When someone either promotes or retires and an opening comes up at a fire station, then you can transfer to the station. He already knows you know his expectations. He knows you've seen you disciplined before. You know kind of the operations of how the administration works. You know what goes on in the car, so you know what he's looking for when you're on the fire ground. And it kind of allows them to build a holistic view of the organization and a relationship before they get assigned to the station. And I was like, that's so profound. I think it's awesome.
For sure.
I mean,
Okay.
we're going to create the position. So when we create it, whether we create it as a driver or a captain, we might as well just go ahead. And another opportunity is that person can slide over when it's time to ride up, and you don't have to move people around, or because that person's already on the car, and it gives them options or opportunities to see the job to go, is this really what I want to do? Do I want to promote?
Okay. And your engines and ladders complement your apparatus overview.
So we don't have any dual houses, except we have a technical rescue team. So we have four on the engine, four on the rescue truck, and all eight of them are a structural collapse technical rescue certified. So the engine and the rescue run together. The rest of the stations, it's either an engine or a quint, depending on where it is in the territory. And all of those positions are captains. There's no in between. There's no like a different rank in between. And then we also have a safety officer that's in a car, and their rank is captain as well.
Okay. And your approximate run totals a year?
We're about 7,000 a year.
Okay.
We do not do EMS. We do first responder. We have a local agency that does transport. So we are a BLS first responder. We still make EMS calls. It's just nobody here has to transport. So that's an attractive tool for recruitment. You know, a lot of times people want to shy away from the ambulances. That's not a problem we have here.
Love that. Okay. And if a first due structural box comes within the limits of spring, what is your first alarm assignment?
Both chiefs, four engines, two ladders on a commercial, four engines, one ladder on a residential. And we have a system. There's five fire departments. We're all dispatched by the same dispatch center. So you wouldn't know where the lines are between territories because everything's based on ABL dispatch.
Gotcha.
So we run seamlessly. We're on the same radio system. So we have about 170-ish square miles of North Harris County. And we all run together daily. And then we even butt up to the next county, and we even run into the other county with another organization, different radio system, but we've worked out all the logistics of that. And our attitude is it doesn't matter what name's on the side of the fire truck or what color it is. It's if you're closest, you get there first, go to work. We've had our district chiefs run other people's fires. Their district chiefs have run our fires because they got there first. There's none of this. It's my side of the line. I want to have territory. All that's gone. We just run with each other as if we're just one large organization. And it's awesome to see that happen.
Yeah. No, I was gonna say no district lines, and that yeah, because unfortunately you still read and see articles of this department gets skipped for the next one, and then they're watching the other truck go by, and like, man, it's
Yeah,
crazy.
it's frustrating. And we used to call it coaches' baseball lineup cards. Like, did you walk into the dispatch center every morning and say, here's who I'm mad at today, don't send them? And that's not the right thing to do. And I'm sure those days, like you talked about, they still happen. And I'm glad that in this area, I'm sure there were many, many years ago those things that have happened. And I've seen it. I've seen people like, why didn't you call us? It was on our side. And I'm like, look, we're just here to do the job. And those days are long gone, and I can't be thankful enough.
That's awesome. Okay. One thing I want to get down to, Chief, is it's astonishing for me is tell the guests Spring's annual budget for training, because that's something to me at least, and everybody I've interviewed, unheard of.
Yeah, so we have 100, like I said, 138 full-time firefighters. We have a couple part-timers, some volunteers. We are probably $750,000 for training. And the reason is the fire chief's mantra is, I want to train you to the point where you can leave, but take care of you well enough so you won't. And he's had a lot of people before say, what if you spend all this money on training, technical rescue, right? These people are getting structural collapse five. We're pushing $100,000 probably a person. You get into that level. And what if you do all this and they leave? And his response has always been, what if we don't and they stay? So Do you want to take the chance of not, you know, or do you want to take the chance of putting all the money in and they're going to leave? Or do you not want to do anything for them and they stay and now you have all these problems?
Right.
So our attitude, and don't get me wrong, it does go through the channels. If you're asking to go to a training in Hawaii, no one's going to say, sure, sounds great, get on the plane.
Right.
Right. You know, there's none of that. But in our area in the Gulf Coast, you know, we deal with floods, we deal with hurricanes. So we have to make sure we're all encompassing of everything. So we want to make sure, like, we send our people through swift water training every other year. And the technical rescue people go to Disaster City to get all structural collapse training because we know that if there's going to be a significant event, i.e., a structural collapse, it's going to outpace our 8-person team in a hurry. So we work with our local agencies, Houston, Magnolia, Cy-Fair, the Woodlands, other people who have technical rescue teams. They work together, they train together to make sure that they can be seamless. When one has an incident, the rest of us will come help. And I think that we have to pour the money into those people to get them to the level we want them to be, because that's what the community expects. We're just very blessed. I mean, we have a large territory that's very populated, which helps bring in a lot of funds. And we want to take what we can to pour back into our people to make sure that they're the most prepared they can be.
Okay. I mean, and to me, it makes sense.
Well, it
There's
makes sense
no,
to me. That's good. No.
I mean, there's nothing like an organization that remembers, like, we have to take care of our members. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying we have to coddle and baby people coming in, but when you have these people who are here and they want to be here, to me, that just shows like you are important. Not just you're not just a body that we need to have on the truck. You are a person, and we are thankful for you.
Absolutely. You know, and one of the most rewarding things is when people apply here, they go through a physical ability test and they go to an interview panel, which is of the staff. It's not the chiefs, it's a captain, a driver, firefighters, like they interview them, right? And then the last step of the process is the chief's interview. It's the fire chief, me as the assistant chief, and the operations chief. And we hear time and time again, which I just think is a testament to the culture of the organization, that when we talk about the PAT test in their interview, we say, how was it? And they said, I just remember how welcoming and how nice all of your people were to me when I showed up to the PAT test, and how encouraging they were as I was going through it, because they wanted me. They don't even know me, right? I just applied for this and I'm testing. They have no idea who I am, but they want to see me win, and they're encouraging. And I think that's a testament to our people who have that culture built of an attitude of, we want to see everyone be successful, whether it's the person who's applying here all the way to the fire chief. If you take care of each other and take care of the community, and, you know, and I'm real big on the Richard Branson thing. If you take care of their employee, you take care of your employees, they'll take care of the customer, right? So I look at it as, if we take care of our firefighters, they're going to take care of the civilians and the citizens that they interact with. So if we treat them well and we give them a good culture, that culture will permeate right into how they serve each other and the community every day.
That's a fact. Okay, I love it. I'm assuming you are a proponent for outside training for individuals, whether it's Houston or Spring, wherever you're at, to get outside sometimes and see and learn what other fire departments are doing.
Absolutely. And we are real big on that here. The problem for us is, since we're 138 strong, it might be cheaper sometimes to bring somebody in.
Right.
Like, I'm going to Richard Viscuso, step up and lead in 3 days, or next week, one of the days. It's at a neighboring department that we partnered with. They brought him here. I've sat through it before. I'm going to sit through it again, because I have to be an example to our organization to say, even at my level, 30 years in the fire service, I'm never going to stop learning. I mean, I'm in grad school and I graduate in 2 months. And people go, why are you going to grad school now? I go, why wouldn't I? I should have done it already. And I just want to continue the path of always being a student, always learning, always doing everything I can to be better. And I always want to be an example to both organizations as someone who, it doesn't matter where you're at in your career in the fire service, you should always be looking for opportunities to get better.
And that's a rarity. Most officers, when they get to a certain point of rank, and then they you add on top of that a certain number of years under their belt, it's like, hey, been there, done that. I'm here, I'm at the mountaintop. I don't need to do anything else.
And I'm with you because I've seen it and I still see it. And I just think that complacency attitude isn't the best way because I look at every time we pull up on the fire ground, every one of them operating when I'm the incident commander, their lives are in my hands. And if I didn't do the training I should have because I got there and coasted and didn't want to make myself better, and God forbid something happens, how am I going to look at myself in the mirror to say, maybe if I would have taken the time and opportunity to go out and get trained and make myself better, today might have been a decision I could have made that would have saved somebody's life instead of putting them in a bad position. And that's just, and I think it all, I mean, to bring it all home, I still think it goes back to the 8-year-old kid who had those big brothers instilling that in them, saying, this is how it's got to be. This is what pride looks like. This is what you doing the best looks like. And this is all we expect from you, and we won't take anything less.
Love that. Okay. I always like to end the interview with a question I always like to ask all the guests. Whether it's Spring and Houston or both, where would you like to see yourself before you decide to hang it all up?
I have aspirations to be the fire chief. I don't know if I'd say it either organization, both organizations. You know, I think that in the position I'm in now, I mean, obviously at Spring, the next thing for me is to go to the fire chief's position. I will say that I'm super blessed to have a very transparent and open fire chief in this organization. There is nothing that he's involved in that he does not involve me in. He has a very servant mentality, servant's heart as well. And his attitude always is, if I go tomorrow and something happens to me, I need you to be able to pick this place up and keep going. Because our people expect that and the citizens expect that. So there's not someone I work with or for that has that. I'm going to keep everything close to the vest. I don't want you to see behind the curtain. He's great at showing me everything. So he is actively preparing me every day to take that job. And I'm super blessed for that. I think that as I move from this chair to that chair, it just gives me more opportunities to serve. So if it's Houston's chief, if it's Springs chief, whatever that is, I'm looking for whatever I can to be a servant to my people up to the day I finally say it's time to go. No matter what rank that is. If I stay in this position forever, then so be it. And I'm going to keep serving everybody that works for me the best I can to my ability every day, just like I wake up every morning thinking, how am I going to make today better for somebody?
And if that were to happen, if you were to become fire chief of Spring, I'm assuming, can you still keep your job with Houston?
So I would retire from there because I think that, and like I said, I'm at 24 years this year. Retirement's already on the horizon for me in Houston. So I would definitely retire from Houston to take that job because I mean I'm already managing both now because I don't want to miss out on opportunities here at Spring and I'm able to kind of juggle both of them just because I'm blessed to be on shift work there, which allows a lot of free time for me to be able to be here and to still do everything that I'm required to do here and serve at the pleasure of the fire chief like we all do. And I think that when I would get into that chair, I don't know if my wife would let me do both because I, and I really think that I don't know. And I personally wouldn't want to do both just because there's so many things that he tells me all the time that you don't really understand until you sit in that office. And there's so many things that I think I would have to juggle and try to manage. I think it would, to serve this organization the best, it would have to be me walking away from the other one.
Because if you don't, either way, one organization is going to suffer. Because
100%.
it's
100%.
you can't, yeah, to balance both roles, those important roles. Yeah,
It's hard to balance them both now.
I see.
And I think it would be so much harder. Like we talked about, there's so many things that happen in that office. The weight of the, I tell people all the time, yeah, I go from four bugles to five bugles, but there's a huge gap between the fourth and fifth bugle. And he even said when he was the assistant chief, he didn't understand the weight and the responsibility that you take on when you're the fire chief until he was the fire chief. And he's like, I can't even articulate it to you to make you understand how heavy that job is until you're actually the one sitting in the chair. And I'm sure every fire chief that listens to this podcast would agree with that.
No, for sure. Okay. And lastly, though, if that were to happen, you're when you look at your life as a Houston fire, because not very many people can say that, because the amount of fires that you've been to in your career with Houston, I'll never see it. And I'm okay with that. Like I think people are put in places in different organizations where, yep, I was a firefighter. I didn't go to the number of jobs as Houston, FDNY, Texas, things like that. But you can look back at your career and just take it all in like you were a Houston firefighter.
Yeah, and I think it's something to be very proud of. And I think everyone should have that pride. I have many friends who are firefighters and other departments that don't respond to the amount of, 300,000 plus incidents a year like the city of Houston does. But there's also the negative of it where you could say that my body's taken way more of a beating than a person. And I've been injured before. I just went through a tumor scare in my spine that I just was off. And was that part of making all those fires? I got injured on the fire ground before I was off for 6 months. And so all those things play a role. Yes, all that experience is a great thing, but it took a toll as being on my body because of being all those opportunities. And my problem is, I want to be in the much of the game as I can. So I'm going to be at the busy stations. I'm going to be where the fires come. I'm going to be where the runs are because that's just who I am as a person. And my body has paid the cost at times because of it. And my mind has as well, because you see more than most people want to see. And I think that when I hang that helmet up for the last time at that organization, it'll be a hard day. I have a really good friend of mine who just retired a couple of months ago, and he said he piled up all his uniforms, to get rid of them. And he said at that moment it kind of sunk in. He said, I'm not going to be a Houston firefighter anymore. And for me, I don't want that to be my identity. The identity for me is I want to be a good father to my two daughters, and I want to be a great husband. And that is the identity that at the end of my career, I want to look and say, I'm proud that I was a firefighter at whatever organization I was at. And the identity I want to be is someone who served the people that worked for him and always had everyone's best interest in mind on the decisions that I made, regardless of where I am.
And to me, that's the bullseye right there. The fact that you're a firefighter, you're a district chief, but it's not all that you are. You still like you want to have a family to come home to. And I think sometimes firefighters that are really passionate into the job can sometimes forget, like, it's a great job, no doubt. But when they hand you your badge or your retirement ceremony, your party, and you walk home and you put the keys in the door, hopefully it's not empty and you have someone to come home to.
Right. And I still will say till my dying breath, it's the best job in the world. I didn't want to do anything else. And still to this day, I would never have been as happy as I am today doing anything else. And to your point, I've seen too many careers ruin marriages, ruin families. They weren't around when they needed to be, which caused friction with children. And for me, I try to do everything I can to always say it's, God, family, fire department, right? Because as cold as it is to say, the day I retire, they're going to promote somebody to fill my spot.
Oh, your spot's already been
Right.
filled way
Yeah.
before.
Yeah. And someone's probably asking, when are you going to retire if they're on the promotional list waiting to get promoted? How much longer you got? And I always remember people being asked that later on in the career, and I thought that's so far away. And then I look back and I'm like, oh my goodness. I mean, I'm at 24 years. Like, I got, less birthdays ahead of me than I do, or more, yeah, less birthdays ahead of me than I do behind me. And I start looking at, wow, even when it comes to the career, I can't believe I'm getting to that point where it's almost someone's going to say, hey, it's time for you to retire. And I want to your point, be able to walk in that house and still have a normal home life and a family and kids that said dad was there for me first, and not have that, gaping hole when I walk out of, because all I ever knew was being a firefighter. Like I said, I don't want it to be my only identity. It's a very proud thing I am to be a firefighter, but I also want people to say he was a great dad. He was a great husband. He was even better friend, who had my best interest in heart, and he was also a firefighter.
Okay. And I think that's the perfect way to end this. Chief, I appreciate you coming on. John was the catalyst that made this happen. Afterwards, when I finished his episode, we talked and he was like, "Hey, I got some people I'll send you." And then he sent your name and I can screenshot and send it to you. He put on there a firefighter's chief. So
That's a
obviously
great compliment.
what you are doing, people see that. And that's another thing I want people to realize. Like, it's easy to say, this is what I do, I've done this, but people are watching you whether you know it or not. And so to me, there's no greater feeling. I'm not a chief, but to have a firefighter say that is a firefighter's chief.
Yeah, that's a fantastic compliment. And John is pretty humble. What he won't talk about how great he that he's a fantastic leader. He's a great father, and I know he's super involved in all of his boys' sports and everything they do. And John, I told him one day, I said, if I had a son, or even if one of my daughters wanted to get in the fire department, that's who I would want to be their captain as a rookie. And he has firefighters who have already said, my children are coming through the academy, and I want them to be your rookie, John. And I can't imagine how big of a compliment that is to a company officer to say that firefighters who are building a legacy in the organization say that I want them to start their career and their path under you, because that's how much confidence they have in him, saying they know that their son and or daughter is going to be trained to the level that they know they need to be, and that John's always going to be looking out for them. He's just a great person. He's a great instructor. And I mean, anytime you get a chance to spend some time with him, he's super passionate. And I love that about him, because I see a lot of that, like with me. It's, I want to be great at what I do. I want to be passionate. And that's why him and I always have some great conversations, because we're very similar.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Chief, like I said, I appreciate it. I loved hearing your story. I loved hearing your outlook. The fact that, you were humbled and as you climb through the ranks, you've never forgotten that you've never let your rank or title get in the way of that ego. And, you still always put your people first. So I just got to say thank you for taking time out of your day to do this.
Well, thank you, Danny, for having me. I mean, I've listened to a lot of the Student of the Game podcasts, and had some, had some great people on here before with some great information. I hope somebody gets a nugget or two out of today that can help them, just like I've gotten from many, many other people I've been blessed to be around. So thanks again for having me, and it was an awesome time.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.